Hello, and welcome back to the Economics Review. Our guest today is an assistant professor of economics at Southeastern Louisiana University. His research focuses on financial innovation in the developing world, including the mobile money revolution that has taken place in sub-Saharan Africa. Holding a PhD in economics from George Mason University, he has published scholarly articles in Constitutional Political Economy, Independent Review, and the Journal of Private Enterprise. It is my pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Scott Burns. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Adi. It's great to be on with you.
To start off, I'd like to ask you to introduce yourself and tell us a bit about your background and your research on the mobile money revolution in sub-Saharan Africa.
Yeah, so you've already kind of touched on some of the key points about myself. My name is Scott Burns, and I am from Louisiana, got my undergraduate degree from Louisiana State University, LSU, and then I got my master's and PhD up at George Mason University outside of Washington, D.C. in Fairfax, Virginia. And it was really when I was an undergrad at LSU. I was an undergraduate student at LSU during the Great Recession back 2009, 2010. And I was fascinated by current events. When I got to LSU, I was not planning at all to major in business or in economics or anything even close to that. I was actually a mass communications student who was also getting a major in political science. But I was so fascinated by what was going on in the economy, and I was working for a newspaper that asked me if I could write some stuff about current events and the economy, just because I had a little bit of background in those topics. That's when I decided to take a few economics classes, and thankfully I had some friends in college who made some really good recommendations on books I should read, things like Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. And then in terms of monetary economics, since the financial system was imploding at that time, I got turned on to the work of Larry White from George Mason University, who wound up being the chair of my dissertation committee, George Selgin, and a bunch of other great kind of free market-minded monetary economists. And that's what really kind of sparked my interest in monetary economics and drove me to want to attend George Mason for my PhD. So went to George Mason, got my PhD up there in 4 years, and got a chance to study under some of my heroes, like, as I mentioned, Larry White. And that's kind of how I got started in monetary economics. I think that you also asked about kind of what got me interested in M-Pesa and mobile money and different financial innovations. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So when I was at graduate school, you know, by the time I enrolled, it was around, 2014 or so, I believe. But yeah. When I enrolled at George Mason, like I said, the Great Recession was, you know, in the rearview mirror. So I was trying to find what the next interesting topics would be. And Bitcoin was something that was very heavily talked about at that time, and then other types of cryptocurrencies. But I kind of stumbled across, doing some research for Dr. White, the issue of M-Pesa, this revolution in digital payments that was taking place in sub-Saharan Africa. And that really captured my attention, because that's a part of the world where we don't exactly expect to see financial innovations taking root. When you look at rankings of economic freedom and then just overall rankings of the world's richest nations and most developed economies, no surprise, mostly sub-Saharan African nations are at the bottom of the list. So the fact that some of the most exciting kind of financial innovations were actually taking root in these really underdeveloped countries was something that I wanted to dig more into. And so that's kind of what got me started on that research topic.
Okay, so in the past, including in an article you did for Oldham, you attributed the success of M-Pesa in Kenya, at least in part, to the lack of regulation, which allowed for maximum innovation and growth. So could you please tell us a bit more about how the regulatory environment in sub-Saharan Africa has impacted the success of mobile money?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, a lot of the success of M-Pesa and other types of mobile monies in Africa was due to the fact that this is a technology that developed faster than the government's ability to understand or regulate it could. And that kind of served as an advantage. It's kind of similar in the United States context to the advent of things like Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, where you had these new technologies that came around that really there was no regulatory infrastructure in place to deal with them at the time. And so there wasn't much that regulators could do at the outset to stop them. But as they became more and more popular, it became more difficult for regulators and different special interest groups to try to step in and say, hey, we need to outlaw these things in their entirety. that's kind of what was happening with M-Pesa and a lot of these other mobile monies in Africa. Because if you look at the case of Kenya, and Kenya is kind of considered ground zero of this mobile money revolution, that's where M-Pesa, which is just short for M being mobile and then Pesa being Swahili for money. Kenya is the first country where this really took off and achieved scale. And if you read a lot of the early papers by the innovators who came up with the idea of M-Pesa, and then the regulators who were initially in charge of kind of overseeing the pilot projects that led to M-Pesa, really what they said was, we don't know what this is going to do. This is such a new innovative technology. We don't know if it's going to be wildly popular. We don't know if no one's going to want it. And we can't even begin to figure out what types of regulations would apply to this kind of new type of innovation. And so we're going to basically set up almost like a regulatory sandbox, sometimes the term that's used. This kind of free space for this new innovation where we're not going to really apply many regulations at all to it. We're going to let it kind of exist in this wild, wild west, because we don't know exactly how this is going to develop, but we do understand that the potential promise and benefits of this new technology and being able to get unbanked people access to basic financial services, the benefits far outweigh any costs that we can see. And so, you know, basically the kind of philosophy that took root in Kenya and other nations was, we don't want to stifle these new types of innovations and products at the outset with too much regulation. We instead want to allow them to kind of exist in a more free market environment. And then if we do come across problems down the road, then we can kind of go back and figure out where those problems are and regulate to that. But it was an environment of what Adam Fear and some other writers I follow have called permissionless innovation. They didn't want regulation to be something that thwarted or prevented new innovations from taking root in the first place.
So with mobile money, as people choose to keep their money as a balance on these apps instead of in traditional banks, theoretically, this should have a tremendous impact on the fractional reserve banking system, decreasing the amount of loanable funds in the economy and thus pulling up interest rates. So is this something that's been an issue with mobile money? And if not, how have sub-Saharan African nations gotten around this?
No, it really hasn't been. If anything, it's contributed to more financial deepening, because the money that people hold in M-Pesa is ultimately backed by money in bank accounts. So it's not the case that people are withdrawing money from private bank accounts in order to hold it in M-Pesa. It's actually the case that with most of these mobile monies as they've developed over time, and you touch on an interesting point, because when M-Pesa was developed, it really was just a payment service. It was kind of like PayPal, or when we use things like Venmo here in the United States. That's kind of what it originally was in Kenya. But over time, as it became a very popular means of making payments, as more and more people began using M-Pesa to conduct not just large-scale remittances and large-scale transactions, but even day-to-day transactions, because the transaction fees were so small, what happened was a lot of banks wound up saying, you know what, instead of trying to fight against M-Pesa and treat them as competitors, what we really should do is try to come up with mobile wallets and apps that allow us to connect with M-Pesa, to partner with them. That way we can say, look, if you like using mobile money, we now have a mobile wallet available for our bank where you can use M-Pesa to deposit money into a savings account where you can earn interest on your savings. And then you're using the same technology, basically sending money as easily as you can send a text message, kind of like Venmo in the United States. You can still do that, but now your money is being held at our bank in an interest-bearing savings account. So that's really, and some of the articles I wrote early on were about this very topic, because if anything, this has contributed to expanding the financial system in a lot of these countries, because now banks can tap into the savings of low-income people living in rural areas who they might not be able to get to a brick-and-mortar bank location. They might not be able to walk into a bank in their community and deposit their savings, because frankly, there might not be any banks in that poor remote region. It's probably not economical for banks to establish branches out in those areas. But because of the advent of mobile money, in effect, anyone that has a cell phone, it's like the bank is in your pocket. And that's what banks have been able to do. They've been able to partner with these mobile money companies, with these basically cell phone companies, and say, look, we're going to allow your customers to save their money with our bank and to send it using M-Pesa and using these other apps. So it's actually been very good for the financial systems in these countries.
Okay, so although it seems like the money is kept as a balance, it's actually being kept within traditional banks in the end, right?
Yeah, ultimately, everything's backed by deposit accounts in traditional banks. And like I said, now it's the case that if you want to, you know, open up an M-Pesa account in a country like Kenya, most of the people that do that now, or at least many of them, will do it through their banks, so that the mobile wallet you're using isn't just, you know, the M-Pesa wallet from Safaricom. This is the telecom company that originated M-Pesa. But rather, it's more like using your bank's app, if that makes sense. If you have an account with Wells Fargo or Chase or a bank like that in the United States, that's kind of more like what's being done in these countries now. They've been able to kind of graft their services, these banks, on the mobile money infrastructure, so that now people can send money from their private bank accounts using mobile money.
So next, I wanted to ask you about the potential applications of the sort of mobile money that this revolution has to develop nations. So although nations like the United States don't possess the sort of financial environment that caused mobile money to explode in sub-Saharan Africa, people here, by and large, still use traditional banking institutions, physical credit or debit cards, cash, so on. Although there are some prominent financial payment applications like PayPal or Apple Pay. So are there any benefits of having a universal mobile money system that North American or European consumers are missing out on? And do you think we'll see a shift towards mobile money in these markets as well?
I think you've already started to see it, because in many ways, what we're talking about when we talk about M-Pesa, I've used this example before, but it's very similar to things like Venmo or Square Cash or any other type of, you know, Apple Pay. We already kind of have those products here in the United States. And as you alluded to in that question, the need for these products isn't necessarily as great in the United States. Because if you look at the percentage of our population that's unbanked, it's only about, I think, maybe 8 to 10% of the U.S. population is unbanked. Most people do have access to bank accounts. And so there's not as much of a kind of untapped demand for financial services as you see in other nations. When we were talking about poor nations, developing countries and sub-Saharan Africa, the percentage of their populations that has no access to a bank account, that's what we call financially excluded, is usually upwards of 50 to 75%. And so you can understand why something like mobile money would be important in those countries. They've got a really bad existing infrastructure of banks. There's not many banks, especially in poor remote regions. And so it took an innovation like mobile money, literally putting a bank in people's phone, in effect, in order to access the unbanked. In the United States, thankfully, because we have a much more developed financial infrastructure, there's not as much of a need for that. But still, you are seeing a lot of advances in similar technologies. The ones I just mentioned are examples of payment platforms that do make it easier for people here in the United States to make payments all around the country and at very low cost.
But I mean, like in Kenya, for example, M-Pesa is almost universal, like virtually the entire population is using it. So does that bring any benefits that North American consumers aren't getting? For example, if we all use one of these systems instead of, you know, having the market fragmented into various financial payment applications, which not all people are using.
I don't necessarily think so. I don't know if there's any economies and scale of having just one type of payment provider. And bear in mind, too, a lot of times when people talk about M-Pesa, they kind of conflate it with things like cryptocurrencies, like Bitcoin. M-Pesa is not a separate type of privately issued money. It's really just a payment service. It's all backed by, in Kenya's case, the Kenyan currency. So we're not talking about a wholly new type of money. We're just talking about a new way for people to send that money and to hold their savings in that money. So it's not the case that we're talking about introducing a new private currency. And I don't know if that's necessarily what you were getting at. We're really talking about a payment application. And it's good to have competition in those type of things. I don't think there's an economy of scale that requires only having one type of app for sending payments. You know, I don't think in the United States example, that it's necessary that everyone just use Apple Pay, that everyone just use Venmo or Square Cash or anything like that. It's good to have competition between these different payment providers, because that's ultimately what helps drive down costs over time. So I don't think there's necessarily any economies of scale that require only having one.
So finally, I wanted to talk to you about some challenges facing mobile money in the future. So as with many new innovations where public adoption is substantial, the technology eventually matures, certain shortcomings become obvious, and the market is once again ripe for disruption. So Dr. Burns, with the mobile money revolution coming up on almost a decade, what are some issues faced by the industry across the developing world? And what is the next big thing for the financial system, for financial systems in these parts?
That's a good question. One of the issues, I think, that a lot of mobile money products in the developing world face right now and are going to continue to face in the future is the fact that, as I just alluded to, these products are still ultimately linked to and backed by whatever the government-issued currency is in those countries. Again, this is not some type of privately issued cryptocurrency that we're talking about. These are just payment services. So one of the things that I could foresee, at least, is that if you've got a lot of financial insecurity in these countries and a lot of financial instability caused by, you know, higher rates of inflation, if central banks are printing too much money and things like that, then mobile money in and of itself can't really do much to help solve that, because you're still stuck using whatever the national money is in these countries. So what I'm hoping to see in the future is that these apps make it easier for people not only to transact in whatever their national currency is, but to trade different types of currency. So that, let's say you're in the country of Kenya. Let's just say that the Kenyan central bank starts to print a lot of money. Maybe they run very high deficits. The government puts pressure on the central bank to start printing more and more money, and that drives up inflation rates. Well, in that case, if you're a Kenyan citizen, you probably don't want to hold as much of your savings in a depreciating currency like the Kenyan shilling. You might want to try to diversify your savings in things like US dollars, the euro, the Tanzanian dollar, some type of other currency whose value is more stable, maybe even something like Bitcoin. Right now, there's not a great infrastructure for allowing people to convert from one currency to another using mobile money, but that is something that's starting to be developed and that I hope does develop, because ultimately, what is most exciting about this technology to me and what got me really interested in this topic is that it provides a basis for what F.A. Hayek called competition in currency. That's another kind of series of articles that really influenced me in my writings and influenced my dissertation chair, Dr. Larry White, and some of his students. The economist F.A. Hayek back in the 1970s started to write a lot about different kind of private or free market solutions and innovations that could take place in the monetary system so that people wouldn't just be stuck using whatever their national government-issued currencies were, especially obviously in the 1970s. He was writing during a time of very high and variable rates of inflation, when people were looking to get out of bad currencies and start using more stable currencies. I'm hoping that we start to see those same exact forces take root in the developing world, where now that we have digital wallets and products like mobile money that make it easier for people to hold their savings and engage in transactions electronically, that they can start to more easily buy and sell different currencies. And even, you know, invest in things like Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, privately issued forms of money, so they have more financial stability, so that their savings are not entirely tied to whatever policies the central bank in their countries pursues. And so I guess, kind of to sum up, to kind of get more directly to your question, what I'm hoping to see in the future, since a potential weakness of, and this is not a weakness that's inherent to crypto, to mobile money necessarily, but because they are ultimately tied to government monies right now, I want to see more apps and more uses developed that make it easier for mobile money users to buy and sell different currencies so they can get out of bad currencies and diversify their holdings, their financial portfolio, to have more options, if that makes sense.
So I think this is where the regulatory environment once again becomes a challenge, because as people's, for example, if mobile money app, applications were to enable you to hold your money in different currencies internationally, that would cause a big problem to the nation, essentially, because if people are now more and more choosing to hold their money as, for example, US dollars, that's actively depreciating the Kenyan currency or whatever the currency of that country is.
Type of currency. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, countries like China have already imposed regulations or a maximum on how much of their currency you can convert in any given year. So, do you think that this is something that has the potential to become a regulatory issue or something that you foresee they will start to regulate if mobile money applications implement this feature? Or do you think the the unregulated market that's been so successful thus far will continue to prevail?
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right that it is a potential problem, and that if you are a regulator or a central bank in a country where inflation rates are high and people are trying like crazy to stop transacting and holding their savings in your currency and trying to hold other ones, then it does make sense that from a self-interested standpoint, those central bank regulators would want to make it more difficult for you to do that. So they might try to impose more stringent regulations, preventing people from transacting in different currencies and things like that. I guess where I'm optimistic, though, is that I think that the private sector and private entrepreneurs' ability to overcome those regulatory hurdles, it's something that gives me optimism, because even though regulators can try their best to make it illegal, for instance, to try to transact in different currencies, and like you said, China is a good example of this happening today, it's ultimately very tough to do that. And so I'm hoping that we see more innovation in the sector where it's just kind of like playing a game of whack-a-mole for regulators, where whenever they try to ban or regulate out of existence one type of app or application, new ones pop up that they're not able to regulate. So you're right to say that could be something that could hinder this market. But really, mobile money itself, in large part, sprang up outside of the parameters of regulation as a way to circumvent the existing financial infrastructure and problems with these nations' financial systems to begin with. So I'm hoping that we can continue to see that, basically, that we continue to see the private market kind of outsmart and outmaneuver regulators' attempt to stifle it. So that's where I have some optimism moving forward.
Yeah, and I think the international currencies, that's really an interesting area with these sorts of mobile money applications, because, of course, if everyone is transacting, if you're going to a store and paying with M-Pesa and the vendor is accepting M-Pesa as well, and that holds true for virtually all consumers and all every vendor in the market, then you could... that opens the door to having a system where if the local currency does start to become unstable, then pretty much immediately you could have people start transacting everywhere in U.S. dollars, right. You know, without any hurdles. You don't have to go and convert physical cash anymore. They don't have to do anything. The only problem then remains that the government, you still have to pay your taxes in the local currency. And right. So that's the only place where it's that could be an issue. But if the local currency is inflating, then paying your taxes shouldn't be an issue at all if you're transacting only in U.S. dollars. So do you think this is a potential danger in the future where countries with very unstable currencies start, because of their access to these sorts of financial technologies, start adopting different currencies altogether?
It definitely could be. This is somewhat related to some of the more recent news over the past couple of years with central banks trying to experiment with digital currencies and issuing their own cryptocurrencies, basically to kind of get their nose into this market a little bit. But again, it's ultimately, I think it's going to be very difficult for governments if they're offering inferior products. I don't think that's going to wind up being sustainable for them, because it's very difficult in this new kind of wild, wild west of the cryptocurrency market or the mobile money market and all these other financial technologies. It's very difficult to ban people from transacting entirely in these marketplaces. And so even if governments try to kind of intervene and get into these markets themselves and offer their own digital currencies and stuff, if they're not high quality services, it's quite easy for people to find ways around the system to transact in other types of currencies. So, again, it's kind of where I'm a little bit optimistic about this, that even though we have seen governments try to jump into the space now that's been so successful, I think the second they start to kind of mess around and screw things up, as they're almost inevitably going to do, that these new products and technologies make it easier for people to get out of those bad systems and into more sustainable, better run ones.
Yeah, and the reason I talk so much about the foreign currency market in these sorts of countries is because it's so relevant to what we've seen in so many countries. El Salvador recently adopted Bitcoin. There have been several African nations that have used the U.S. dollar in the past, along with developing nations all over the world, actually. I think Venezuela, had an inflation crisis, they switched over to using US dollars. So that's right. That's just something that we've seen happen in large part across much of the developing world at one point or another, where the currency just becomes so unstable as a result of all these factors. The central bank tries to inflate away their problems, and then everything, all hell breaks loose, essentially, and the currency becomes worthless. Right. So I think one last issue that I wanted to touch on here, if this were to become a reality, right, obviously it's a very difficult thing to regulate if people are, you know, in their own private financial lives or in their own private transactions, they choose to use an app which allows them to convert their money before using that to transact, and that starts to gain popularity. Then yeah. What I think there's one sort of issue that I see here in that countries, especially in the developing world, neighboring countries start to develop something of a competitive market for each other's currencies. And then, you know, for example, if country A is now more and more, the country A's currency is becoming more and more unstable, that country B tries to advertise or tries to provide incentives to country A to switch over to country B's currency, because that's good for them. And it depreciates country A's currency, which is their competitor. So do you think this could have the potential to cause some diplomatic issues potentially? And overall, do you think that a competitive market for each other's currencies is something that's desirable?
Oh, no, I definitely think it's more desirable than the status quo, or at least what we've had for most of history under fiat monies, where people have been stuck using whatever currency, you know, their government issues in whatever country they happen to live in. I see what you're talking about almost this kind of race to the bottom that could happen if countries try to almost attack each other's currencies and encourage people to switch to theirs. But that's only going to be successful to the extent that there really are problems with other nations' currencies. I don't think these currency attacks would be too successful if a government was trying to convince somebody. If the Kenyan government, for instance, was trying to convince Tanzanian citizens, hey, switch to the Kenyan currency, switch to Kenyan shillings because the Tanzanian government's doing a really bad job. I think that'd only be effective to the extent that they were correct, and to the extent that people living in Tanzania really did see that their central bank was mismanaging the money supply, driving up inflation rates and things like that. So it's really no different than any other product in the private marketplace. I mean, what you're discussing is really just kind of at the governmental level, the same way that competition works at the private level between different companies in the shoe market, or in the payment service market, or any other market. If you can make the pitch to people that your product is better run than others, then I don't see any problems necessarily stemming from that type of competition. As long as you're offering a superior product and you can back up the talk, then we want to see those companies thrive, and in this case, those currencies thrive that do a better job of maintaining stable purchasing power. Yeah, it might drive up some political tensions between different nations if there's competition in currencies, but that's the type of competition that we want to see. Competition that drives them to say, okay, if we want to avoid the situation and avoid having a currency crisis with a neighboring country, then we need to get our own house in order. We need to make sure that our central bank is behaving in a way that promotes price stability and gives investors confidence so that they won't be tempted to jump out of our currency and into another one. So that's exactly the type of competition, frankly, I'd want to foster in international currency markets.
Well, those are all the questions that I have for you today. It's been absolutely amazing speaking with you. Thank you so, so much for joining us on the show.
Yeah, no, I really enjoyed talking to you too, Ivy. Hopefully I get a chance to talk to you again soon.
Yep. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Economics Review. And as always, we'll be back soon with the latest.